Okay. We continue our meeting, and we're going to talk about the conceptual framework, which we had a lengthy discussion on yesterday with the board, and Rachel is going to tell us about it.
Peter, actually, to start with.
Okay. Yeah, good afternoon, everybody. So I'll give you a quick update on where we've got to on the project, and then Rachel's going to talk to you about measurements. The board has already discussed most of the issues that we think they need to discuss before issuing an ED. There's a summary of the decisions in the appendix to Agenda Paper 6. Yesterday the board discussed three topics. Two of them are ones we're coming to later on, measurements and implications of long-term investment. The board also discussed distinction between liabilities and equity, and whether we needed to consider any changes to the existing or the currently proposed definitions of a liability and of equity. And the board's tentative conclusion was that the definitions for the ED will be in line with what's in the discussed in the appendix to this paper. The board is continuing to discuss classification issues in its research project on financial instruments with characteristics of liability. Is looking at a number of approaches. Some of those approaches might involve considering whether we should change the definitions. But for the exposure draft on the conceptual framework, the board is not proposing to change the definitions at this stage. We've now discussed most of the issues. We've got a few issues still to discuss, hopefully mainly in October. Things like consequential amendments, transition, and also some follow-up from the measurement discussions yesterday. We're aiming to develop a draft to start circulating, and we would like to send you a fatal flaw draft at some stage. In the paper we've suggested late October, early November. I think that might prove to be a little optimistic. It might be a little bit later than that. But we don't hope to make it Christmas writing or Christmas reading, but we'll do our best. But it's in the relatively short term anyway that we're expecting to pass something on to you. And we're hoping that you'll all be able to participate in that process when we get there. I'll just pause there and see if anybody has any questions or comments before we move on to the specific topics.
Okay.
Just one question. You mentioned consequential amendments. What do you mean by consequential amendments?
That's a very good question, and probably consequential amendments might not be the best word, but there are various things that
raise hopes
or fears possibly as well. Mm-hmm. There are various things that might need doing. First of all, there are some standards that refer directly to things in the framework. For example, parts of IS1 and IS8 use wording that's very closely tied into the framework. So the board would need to consider whether it needs to make any amendments to those. Then there are, clearly there are broader questions. For example, what happens if a standard is in conflict with the new framework? And that, we wouldn't expect the board to do that as a consequential amendment. That would clearly need to be a separate project. Any proposal to develop it would need to go through the full normal process. So it's really assessing what kind of issues there might be there to deal with. And when I said consequential amendment, that was probably too much shorthand. I think what we would recommend to the board is that if anything is proposed for a change as a sort of direct consequence of the framework, it wouldn't be a consequential amendment tucked away at the back. It would actually be a separate but simultaneous exposure. That's what we would propose to the board to make sure it gets enough visibility.
Bonsoir.
Yeah, to take an example, you have in IS37, if I'm not mistaken, a form of replication of the definition of the liability and of the recognition criteria. Would that, in your view, be?
No, that's considerably more than
a consequential amendment.
Just to be sure. No, it's more the work, particularly the wording in IS1 and IS8, that's really very closely tied into the framework and sort of coexists with it and depends to some extent on the framework for its functioning.
The ones that fell off AIP.
Things roughly in that area, let's put it like that.
Yukio?
Yeah, thank you. Although the ISB, the work on the conceptual framework to date is appreciative, but We do not think that the IASB has fully considered the issues relating to profit or loss and OCI. Considering the critical importance of the project, it seems necessary to spend more time to discuss relevant issues before moving to the exposure draft. In addition, the IASB's tentative decision regarding the definition of liabilities and equities do not seem to be congruent with each other. It seems questionable if the IASB has had a significant discussion regarding liability and equities in conceptual framework project while undertaking full-fledged research project on the same issue. In this context, we felt that IFRAG's discussion paper about classification of claims provided a very good foundation. Drawing from the analysis in the discussion paper, we believe that the IASB should be clear at least about what the distinction between liabilities and equities should purport to achieve. For example, the IFRAG's discussion paper identified that distinction between liability and equity should play a role to represent the following matters, namely entities' liquidity, entities' solvency, entities' financial performance, and return to holders of a particular class of instrument. In addition to respect to measurement bases, we are not sure if the ISB had the sufficient deliberation before publication of the exposure draft, given that measurement is such a complicated and important area. So we suggest that ISB give further consideration to the relationship between selection of measurement bases and the definition of profit or loss.
Rebecca?
I guess we have a similar concern as Yukio is expressing, is that there are certain areas that could be further developed. And I've heard today some references to the framework being an aspirational type document that will, shall we say, lead standard setting. And I guess what we've kind of come to realize is that the ISB has selected an approach which is about completing this project in a timely basis. And what we've seen is that there's some compromises that have been made. So we've got some tough issues that require further thought and consideration. And really, when we step back, we see there's kind of two views of people, and we really experienced that when we met with our conceptual framework discussion group. So it consists of members who were past ISB members, past Accounting Standards Board members, practitioners and preparers who have this view of where should we lead in standard setting. And when they look through those decisions, they've seen that a lot of, should we say, what are the proposed updates, is really based on current thinking, work that's been done in standard setting. So when you look at the work that we've kind of gone through in developing these proposals, both the work the ISB's done and stakeholders, how do we measure that success? Maybe that the success is that we're actually building acceptance and bringing that current thinking into the framework. But to kind of bring the two groups together, we think it'd be really helpful when you go to release the exposure draft that you start to link the other projects that are underway or identify those tough issues that we need further thought on so that we can see a more comprehensive plan. So whether it's the research that's starting on liabilities and equity, the disclosure framework, that if you can outline a more comprehensive way what those issues are and how there's an approach and plan in place to keep developing with a thought to come back to updating the framework, that might help to, shall we say, move that conceptual thinking forward as well.
Angus?
I guess along the similar lines of what Rebecca has said, I'm sure Peter and Rachel are well aware of the AASB's views, and I think we've sort of come to the realisation that we have a different view of what a conceptual framework is than perhaps the ISB does. I mean, putting it bluntly, we think you've probably built too much of your standard setting thinking into the framework, whereas our view would be it's got to be the other way around. And unless you actually aspire to something more conceptual, you won't actually progress in the standard setting sphere. And I think it's a long-term process. So I guess we're now accepting that this review process is part of a longer process of improving the conceptual framework.
Angus, I've heard that said a few times in Australia about, yeah. And it's emanated first from two or three people who managed to spread it. I've always challenged it. You know, this claim that we're just reflecting what's in current standards. I don't think that's true. May not be aspirational enough, you know, for some people. And if we get the measurement, you know, we go back to what model are we working on and all that sort of thing, which AASB's made good points on in the past. But I really don't feel that the overall criticism is justified.
I mean, and that's fair enough. I guess probably the thing, you know, where it really is highlighted for us is there seems to be an awful lot of thinking about the OCI-PNL distinction in the framework that comes out of standard setting. I mean, before we adopted IFRS, we'd never heard of OCI. That's not quite true, but you know, that distinction seems to have been hardwired into the ISB's thinking.
Well, I think an interesting outcome of this whole exercise will be that we have not been really able to find a very clear conceptual basis for OCI, except for in dual measurement. And there where OCI functions as a sort of a...
bridging item.
A bridging item, yeah. Those are the two.
Yeah. I know we're on the record as having said you haven't come up with a basis for OCI. I think probably what we were implicitly really saying was we don't agree with having this two-way split.
But that's reasonable, but that doesn't mean that we're only doing it because of our existing standards.
Sure.
And trying to justify.
Sure, I was being blunt, Ian.
Roger?
Well, I'd like, this sounds odd actually, I know, but I'd like to congratulate the ISB on where they've got to. They call me a sycophant if you like, but I think actually you have listened. I mean, there's been quite a lot of changes in this process, so you have listened. But I think the conceptual framework is anchored much more in what users might want than I think previous ones have been. And I'm not sure you should go that much further than what users want in standards without regressing it. And I think there's one or two examples of standards, even the intangible asset discussion we're having before lunch, you know, which might have sounded conceptually exciting, but I'm not sure you wanted that. So there are several areas in the current draft which we still regret, for example, the absence of reliability, but we have another whole session to try and get those sort of things back again in the exposure draft stage. But I think you've done a very good job.
Thank you. Tom?
I just wanted to make the observation that it's not clear to me, even though they've got no point, that there is a conceptual justification for distinguishing when you want to do current value in the statement of financial position and something else in the statement of comprehensive income. So while there's a statement in your current, in the framework that you might be thinking about that, I have a very, very hard time thinking when in meeting the objective of financial reporting that I would think I'd want to do a current measure in the statement of financial position and not also have the resultant unrealized incremental gain and loss in profit or loss. And so while there is a statement in the framework that suggests that's the role for OCI, I think you could go further to be able to justify why you actually think that there might be that difference.
You think there is we could find a better legitimation for
well, that. Or you might end up deciding, which I tend to lean towards, that when it's legitimately should be in the statement of financial position, there's a place for it in the statement in profit or loss.
Okay.
But there might be areas where it's just not really legitimately should be in either place.
Okay. Then we should do away with fair value OCI. look, that is, of course, you know, if we were to write a truly aspirational conceptual framework with, for example, we would say, well, you know, we've taken a closer look at OCI and there is really no place for it, and everything should go P&L, and more fair value, we could do all that. But then I think there would be really cause for us to wait for another 5 years to complete our work.
Well, I think there's issues related to performance statement that might help you with that too.
Françoise?
Yeah, first of all, I would like to echo Roger with the positive comments.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Yeah, I've been told by Michel I should do better. So I wanted to echo, especially when I make compliments, I want them to carry out loudly. No, because the reason is, I think it's something that we have said in the past, which is that constituents, practitioners must have a good understanding of what is directing your thinking while you set standards. So if you were developing a conceptual framework that for some reason you don't believe could reflect in accounting just tomorrow, then you would not have a conceptual framework that brings the understanding in the work you do. So you would continue to have difficulties in, you know, difficult projects, due process that just never end because people just can't understand or just accept what is being developed. So less ambition in the accounting model means a much greater ambition in terms of the acceptability of the work you do. And I personally believe that that acceptability is a key in bringing improvement in practice, which is exactly what you're after. We'd like just to, because it's been addressed, otherwise I would have waited until the ED is out and we comment formally, but I can't resist. After having heard what's just been said about OCI and first of all the fact that you already acknowledge that you want to develop standard settings that serves meaningful performance reporting as well, meaningful financial position reporting is important, and the fact that you identify that OCI may be a way of bringing more content in the information on the balance sheet, nevertheless not diluting the way people look and understand their performance is important. In fact, that's the reason also why we had recommended that there would be a business model notion there, because and probably it's difficult to go any further in the conceptual framework, but it's something that should indeed remain open so that in when you consider a particular standard at standard level, you can use those tools and apply them in a very openly manner on something that remains high level, like a conceptual framework should be.
Thank you, François. Any other comments? Rachel? Clement, sorry.
Yeah, I echo Roger's comment that by and large, I think the overall sort of conclusion on various part is take a good sort of balance between the complexity and the applicability. The only area that I like to raise is on the part talking about the prudence, and it says that the prudence is consistent with neutrality, and you did provide some sort of explanation why you said that. But I think the traditional concept of prudence within the context of accounting is does have a big contrast with neutrality, and by getting wrong and say that, well, we draw reference to prudence, I'm not sure whether it's the right way to address that.
Well, we solved it by saying that it is consistent with neutrality, which is the way it was written in the previous conceptual framework as well, supportive of neutrality. Mary?
I just, at the risk of coming across as a bit defensive, wanted to come back to echo Ian's comments about anchoring in, you know, the CF or not, in being constrained by existing standards. And I'm coming back on this point because I think it would be a great help if you had our perspective when, you know, Rebecca, as you say, when you're talking to outreach groups in Canada, to have a different perspective. And I also thought your ideas about ways to try and bring people along in terms of understanding the project were quite helpful suggestions. The point is, because we went in saying we want to focus on the areas that need improvement where we have encountered problems in previous standard setting projects, it's inevitable that a lot of our debate has started out with where, you know, what standard setting projects have given us problems before, where either the CF hasn't been a help or we have found ourselves trying to, you know, reaching conclusions that were inconsistent with the, you know, with our existing conceptual framework. So I think inevitably if you just, you know, if you monitor the discussion to say, oh, look, they're talking about conceptual framework, but once again, they're going back to recent standard setting projects. It really has been not how do we justify those or distill them. You know, it's not conceptual framework as a codification, but it's been an attempt to say we're trying to do targeted changes and let's focus on those areas where we found have needed a fix. But, you know, I'm very comfortable as a board member working on this that we haven't said we cannot go beyond the conclusions we've reached or we must find a conceptual justification for everything that we have done in standards projects or even in the last 5 years of standard setting. So I think explaining that consideration of recent problem areas, you know, has been grist for the mill. It's something that it's a perspective I've asked you to, not just you personally, but others to carry forward when, if you know, if you hear that, because I think that does a lot of harm in terms of people's attitudes. When, you know, when they pick up the draft.
Nevertheless, you know, when the staff comes forward with its draft and we can get a complete overview of what we have produced, we should take another look. Is this, you know, is this going far enough? Does this bring us forward sufficiently? But for some problems, like OCI P&L, we could take another 10 years. And it will not be solved. That I'm absolutely sure. In other areas, for liability equity, there we could say, wait another year and we might have more results in our work that they are doing and we could have a better definition. That's true. But, you know, can we hold up the whole project for that? That's the question. Rachel?
Thank you very much. I'd like now to move on to the area of measurement, and what we'd like to do here is to get your feedback and comments on the tentative decisions that we've made so far on the measurement section of the conceptual framework. Agenda paper 6 provided you with a summary of the decisions that we have made up to and including the July board meeting. But as Hans said at the beginning, we spent quite a lot of yesterday talking about measurement and discussing selection of measurement bases and measurement categories. And so I thought what it would be useful to do is to provide you briefly with a complete overview of all the decisions that we've made so far and what decisions are left to make on the measurement section of the conceptual framework. So I'll start off with the overall strategy that we decided to take on measurement. And that was basically to build on the suggestions in the discussion paper, modified in the light of feedback received on that discussion paper. We did receive quite a lot of feedback saying that what we ought to do is perhaps to undertake some more fundamental research on measurement, but the board actually thought that we could introduce some significant improvements and some significant guidance on measurement into the conceptual framework without undertaking any additional research work on that area. We did, however, decide to make a number of changes to the way that the conceptual framework dealt with measurement compared to what we proposed in the discussion paper. In particular, we decided that we'd try and focus on describing different measurement bases and the information that those measurement bases might provide in both the statement of financial position and the statements of profit or loss and OCI. We'd also focus on discussing the factors that we would consider in selecting a particular measurement basis. We'd try and explain the link between the measurement section and the use of OCI. And in addition, we'd remove quite a lot of the detail that was in the discussion paper about the implications of different measurements for particular types of assets and liabilities. That detail had been criticised by a lot of the respondents in the discussion paper as really straying too much into standards level detail. So on the basis of that strategy, we developed a series of measurement papers and discussed them with the board. We decided to replace the objective of measurement that we proposed in the discussion paper with a general description of what the process of measurement is trying to achieve, and then went on to discuss whether we should be looking at the use of a single or a default measurement basis. And quite a number of respondents had actually suggested the use of a single or default measurement basis. However, in the discussions yesterday, we reconfirmed the decision to effectively go ahead with a mixed measurement model. But the way we've articulated that has changed somewhat. And what we're saying here is that when we consider things like the objective of financial reporting, the qualitative characteristics, and the cost-benefit constraint, we're likely to conclude that different measurement bases are appropriate for different types of assets and liabilities. So it's a slightly different articulation of the mixed measurement approach that I think we're going to end up with within the conceptual framework. We then went on to discuss a number of factors that you would actually need to consider in selecting a measurement basis, and have come up with a series of factors that you need to consider. Each of these factors should be considered, but the relative importance of each of the factors will depend upon the facts and circumstances when looking at the particular things and the standard setting decisions that we're making. The first of those factors to consider is to think about not only the information that a particular measurement would produce in the statement of financial position, but also to think about the information it would produce in the statement of comprehensive income. So thinking about both income statements and also the balance sheet. We then decided that we would carry forward the suggestion from the discussion paper that how an asset or liability contributes to future cash flows is one of the factors that you should consider in selecting a measurement basis. And we went on to say that how an asset or liability contributes to future cash flows will depend, in part at least, on the business activities that have been conducted. We also decided to carry forward some of the discussion of how faithful representation, the qualitative characteristic of faithful representation, affects measurement from the discussion paper, and in particular pointing out that faithful representation on its own is not usually sufficient, the information must also be relevant, and that you would also may need to consider any potential linkage between assets and liabilities when considering whether you have a faithful representation or the measurement that you've selected results in a faithful representation. Moving on to other factors to consider, one of the things that the board suggested was that we need to consider the level of measurement uncertainty associated with an item, so with an asset or liability when selecting a measurement. But we do go on to say that actually that doesn't mean that you cannot use a measurement that has a high degree of measurement uncertainty associated with it. Sometimes a measurement that has a high degree of measurement uncertainty is the only thing that actually provides any relevant information about an item, but it is a factor to consider. We also said you need to think about the characteristics of an asset and liability when thinking about measurement, and by the characteristics we think we mean things such as the extent of variability in cash flows, or sensitivity of that item to changes in risks or market factors. We'll also include a discussion of the enhancing qualitative characteristics and how they might affect measurement. And also, we'll make an explicit reference to cost-benefit within the measurement section. Arguably, we didn't need to do that because, of course, it's a pervasive constraint, cost-benefit, throughout the conceptual framework. But we thought it was something that we would generally be thinking about when we're thinking about measurement. It was useful to reiterate that within the measurement section. One of the things in particular we probably need to think about when thinking about cost benefit in the measurement section is the costs and benefits associated with introducing any new or different measurement bases. clearly they can have, they may actually provide more relevant information to custom designing a measurement basis, but there are costs associated with that in terms of complexity and understandability. We've also decided to provide some guidance that connects to the decisions that we've made on OCI about when it would be appropriate to use one measurement basis for the statement of financial position and a different measurement basis for profit or loss. And that's basically, again, thinking about the business activities and believing that that would provide more relevant information about the business activities of the entity. We'll also provide guidance on initial measurement and some guidance on cash flow-based measurement techniques. Now, there's a shift in the way that we talk about cash flow-based measurement techniques from what was proposed in the discussion paper. The discussion paper talked about cash flow-based measurement techniques in terms of it being effectively a type of measurement basis or a measurement category. We've moved away from that somewhat, and so we don't identify cash flow-based measurements as being a separate measurement category. Instead, we say that in general it would be used to estimate one of the other types of measurement basis that we describe within the conceptual framework. However, we're not ruling out the idea of using cash flow-based measurement techniques in some circumstances to custom design measurements if we believe that that is particularly appropriate. But generally, it will be used to estimate the other measurement bases that we describe. That leaves us with one big remaining area that we need to talk to the board about, and that's in relation to the description and discussion of the different measurement bases. We took a paper on that to the July meeting, and they asked us to go away and recategorise the measurement bases. We discussed it again at the September meeting, where we had recharacterized measurement bases as either entry or exit type bases. The board weren't as keen on that idea and has actually asked us to go away and try and group measurements into historical cost-based measurements and current measurements and look to perhaps cut back on the amount of detail that we have within that description of the different measurement bases. The only other thing that we are hoping to discuss in October on measurement is in relation to transaction costs, but I'm hoping that that will be a relatively short time. So with that brief summary overview of where we've got to with measurement, I'd like to open it up for comments.
There's three reactions that I have to three issues. And in order of importance, I'll start with the one I think that's most important. I am concerned, I don't disagree with your decision that some of the estimated cash flow methods are really ways of approximating something else. But I do think that there is, you're going to leave a hole in the framework if it's not a third measurement category, especially if what you have to end up doing is in certain estimated cash flow techniques that are not trying to approximate a transaction price on day one, especially subsequent measurements, when you remeasure cash flows, but not trying to get the cash flows that the market participant views are, or you remeasure a discount rate, but not to the market rate, but some other sort of rate, you're going to lose an opportunity to be able to be thinking about guidance and measurement about decisions about discounting and how you think about OCI. Because if what you end up doing, I think the estimated cash flow subsumed within the other two measures is mostly, from my view, is easily defended about initial measurement. But when you move forward on subsequent measurement, it's not clear to me what's going to be happening when you remeasure, as I said, remeasure cash flows to other than market participants' views, or remeasure discount rate to something other than a market rate. And I think you're going to get questions raised about when you remeasure either a discount rate like insurance to other than a market rate, whether you ought to be thinking about OCI. So some of the things that are going to come out of the measurement chapter are going to be connected to selection of discount rates and selected to whether or not you go into OCI. And if it's remeasurement of really long-dated cash flows, I know that there's some conversation about whether that ought to be current or somehow an OCI. And if you're going to remeasure the discount rate, how do you think about it? And so I do believe there's another category, especially in subsequent measurement, that I'd encourage you to think about, a third category of estimated cash flows. Because mostly when we think about historical cost, we think about that original transaction price, and we can do two things with that thing. One is just allocating it. But the other one might be remeasuring the dimensions of it, especially when the first approximation is a cash flow. And I think that there are things that you are going to lose an opportunity, as I said. That's point number one. Yeah.
Mary, you want to get in?
I do, just to point out something in Rachel's vocabulary that I want to see if you were considering in those comments, which is that she said we asked her yesterday to go back and try and think about grouping things into two categories of historical cost and current value. She didn't say fair value. And the purpose, the emphasis on current value was, as you say, when there are updates that may not be to a market participant's view. So electing a market participant's view is and doing a complete update are the two things that make it a fair value rather than...
Or a current value.
You know, or that make it a fair... it's doing both of those things that make it a fair value. Doing only the update may make it a current value, which is why that's a pretty broad category. So were you thinking, because your comments about if you don't make this a third category, you'll leave a hole for some of the other debates. I don't see if you're thinking about current value as broader than just fair value.
I do. And I think that, let's say there's two current values, primarily to talk about an entry price and an exit price. Mm-hmm. I think even if you're going to approximate an entry price, it ought to be the market participant's view of the cash flows at entry and a market participant's view about the discount rate related to entry. I don't think it can be approximating a current value for an exchange price in an entry market, other than that if it's got a market view, it's an entry market price. And that's different for me from saying, I'm going to take management's view of the estimates of cash flows, or I'm going to take an arbitrary, at this point, because we've not developed anything about discount rates, an arbitrary discount rate other than some sort of market benchmark rates. And within our accounting system, we have chosen to estimate cash flow sometimes to try to approximate transaction prices, but other times we just permit management's view of those items. And we certainly have introduced with our own inconsistencies a whole range of different discount rates that have nothing to do in reference to any market term structure in an entry or an exit market. And we are remeasuring based on, sometimes remeasuring those cash flows subsequently from a management view, sometimes reassessing discount rates. And I think those are dimensions of measurement that need some focus compared to starting with an original transaction price and you just allocate it over time and impair it. But you just allocate and impair it. That's a whole different...
When we talk about insurance with the insurance industry, and we all understand what we mean when we say it's a current model that we're developing.
Right.
It is current measurement.
And that may not be as problematic in the gap I'm thinking about, but when we estimate cash flows on contingent liabilities, we're not trying to approximate any settlement in the market even remotely. In all the discounting that we do, other than in a current value environment, right now we've just arbitrarily sort of thought about that. I think those are subsequent measurement decisions far different from allocations. And I believe measurement, the challenges of measurement are mostly about subsequent measurement, not initial measurement.
Yeah.
And it's because of the implications on the statements of comprehensive income. And those are things that I think will flesh out a chapter far better and really drive home to why people care. I don't think really that they care whether the transaction price is really market or not at original transaction versus that some of those choices are whether we add on costs to a transaction price. That's the difference between what we do in it and a historical cost model, even with estimated cash flows versus a fair value model. That's your transaction cost sort of issues, or costs that we're going to queue up in the asset value because they're going to be recovered in the future. Those are choices in initial measurement. I don't think that they're as fundamentally important as what happens when we choose to move forward and affect the income statement through subsequent measurement processes. And I think you're losing an opportunity and not thinking about that other class. Just my view.
Yeah, I just wanted to describe the different measurement bases that we were planning to actually include under the current, the sort of broad category of current. It does include the fair value, so the market participant exit, but we would also include in there a current entry. Mm-hmm. But we would also think about exit values, which are from an entity-specific perspective, so things such as value in use and fulfillment value within that broad description of current measurement bases. So to some extent, and admittedly, when you're looking at something like value in use and fulfillment value, you're having to use cash flow-based measurements to actually come up with those, but we are actually defining them as separate, distinguished, identifiable measurement bases within that current category.
And I think that's a good thing to do. I think there's other classes of cash flow measurements and remeasurements, discounted or undiscounted, that we have within our reporting model that I'm not sure is going to be easily dealt with separate from if you just lump them into an historical cost model.
But we're not worried about justifying past price.
Why?
I'm not sure whether to really agree with Tom or disagree with him. Because I like the idea that the ISB has more strictly, I think, said there are measurement bases and then there are measurement techniques. And we always regarded cash flow, discounted cash flows, as a technique that might be used to achieve different types of measurement bases. And I had assumed from what Rachel had said that having identified this, if you like, family of current values, that's where they would examine the issues that you've raised, Tom. But if it was going to be bad cash flow methods again, I think that misleads people into thinking that's a basis in itself.
We're starting preliminary pre-agenda research on a measurement chapter, and we've come to the conclusion that we don't have measurement bases or measurement attributes within the accounting model, that what we have is measurements. And we might be able to even call it something else. But the sum total of everything that we do, that there are many, many things we do in measuring items that don't try to achieve any particular observable objective in the markets. And so if that's the case, I'm describing another family of measurements, not a measurement attribute or a measurement base, because I don't think we have always measurement attributes or bases.
Should we have?
Well, that's an open question, but I think as soon as you make the decision that it's a mixed attribute model, I think you've made it.
There you go.
Tom, you know, I agree with you. We have to carefully consider those factors as you described. And the board start in the DP three categories. Actually, yesterday, from beginning, I still favor three categories. But the difficulty is, particularly Sue asked, I think, a very good question. You know, Mary just mentioned some of the measurement bases or others close to the current value we should put. It seems no controversy over these the bases. But on the other hand, if we still want to keep third ones, then the question is, what are those bases we will classify, call them as historical costs? One example is, yesterday we discussed about amortized financial instruments. Which category we put in? And the discussion among ourselves, I think most board members will favor to categorize as cost side.
That's why we call it amortized cost.
Yeah.
So
what we conclude yesterday is we have brought two categories and not consider something and put something in another third category, which you can say, you can umbrella everything there, but others like Angus said, are they actually basis or techniques, you know?
I think they're techniques. I would have two. I look at things differently, initial and subsequent. I think at initially we have a family of measurements that are historical transaction based that we add things to, all right,
yeah,
for other purposes. And then we have typically a clean current value measure, whether it's entry exit price. So there's two classes there. But then when I move forward to subsequent, I think we have measurement techniques within that historical cost category. Because once you start amortizing and depreciating and accreting and doing all that other stuff, there's no measurement objective or attribute that you're achieving there. You're doing math. You're calculating things, right?
They're allocating.
There's allocated. And that's why I would have, once you start with that initial, in that family, you've got allocations, and then you've got remeasurements.
It's a rough approximation of measurements. You're trying to mimic in a cost-efficient way what you think is economic reality.
But Tom, even, you know, day one, initial measurement is not so easy.
No,
as
I
you just described, many of the day one recognition of measurements is based on discounted future cash flow. And, you know, mix so many things from beginning already.
So that's why I think sometimes a discounted future cash flow is trying to approximate a historical transaction price, but sometimes it's just a calculation at initial. For some sort of sum of cash flows, it's not trying to get a transaction price there because there has been no transaction. And we've got to account for something in a way. And we decide to account for that event and circumstance without a transaction by doing cash flows, not trying to get a historical transaction price or a current entry or exit price. That's why I think there's a separate class in entry price. But I think it's even more fundamentally important moving forward that we don't have a conversation to believe every time we have that original amount, if it's not a current value remeasurement, that all we're doing is allocating. Because sometimes we're allocating, but sometimes we're choosing to remeasure cash flows and or remeasure discount rates, not to market participant views. And those sort of choices, I think we need to be thinking about why we do that. When we do it, why is that better in achieving the objective than allocating or remeasuring to a entry or exit objective? And that's the opportunity I think that we have in a measurement chapter that perhaps you're losing the opportunity to think about more robustly by trying to subsume the cash flow measurements into the historical cost model. But you can choose to agree or disagree with that. That's just the view.
That was your main point.
That was the main point.
That was going to happen. That was good.
The second point I wanted to, there is a decision that you have that you'd say when you're thinking about measurement attributes that you should it should depend on how an asset contributes to future cash flows. I like the statement contributes to future cash flows, but there is a dimension to that that I think can be more contextual. Is it how it's going to contribute to future cash flows as you think about how you'd like it to do today? Or is it reflective of where your activities might change with a dynamic business environment in the future? Now, certain business activities and certain sorts of investments, you're constrained, you have impediments from changing how you do it. If I invest in property, plant, and equipment to build widgets, and it's the base of my business, if I were to choose to end up changing that business model by selling it further in the future, I could have huge problems in being able to continue my broader business activities because it's used together with everything else. But if you turn to some financial assets, you can very easily, for a loan, say, I plan to cash collect it out. But there may be markets available that when dynamics change and interest rate changes or credit changes, you could sell it in the future. What future cash flows are you referring to? The ones that there's the possibility of them being able to get to, or the ones that they're expecting at the start? And when I look at future cash flows, I think about if I take seriously your decision to talk about adding stewardship and management's decisions as to how to use the assets in the future. If I could sell that loan at a greater price in the future than what I could get by cash collecting it out, because I think credit's worse than the market is, you'd think you'd have to sell that thing. So what dimensions are you talking about in measurement when you say future cash flows? If there's no impediments to changing your business activity, does that mean that you ought to be thinking about things differently than from when there are impediments? And it seems to me when I read that, it's more of a decision what I'm doing today is what's going to judge how future cash flows are. And I don't think we're necessarily just accounting for today. We're accounting for and expect businesses to be dynamic. And I think that's a dimension that's worth at least contemplating when you think about how you talk about future cash flows. And my trivial point is I don't like you putting the cost constraint in measurement. If you're doing it there, does that mean you have to put it everywhere else in the framework? Because it doesn't have meaning except if you put it in another place?
Yeah. I think Rachel conceded that. Stephen.
I've got another question, Brangus. So the measurement that we've come up with for insurance, this we called it current fulfillment value, is that a measurement basis or a measurement technique?
Well, I mean, we would distinguish the framework from the standard setting, but if I was going to categorise it as something, I would call it one of the family of current value measures.
But it's not market-based.
No.
So does that mean that anything is a measurement basis, even if it's not market-based?
Well, I think what you're trying to do in the framework is limit or put a framework around the sorts of measurement bases you are going to have in your standards. I think at the standards level, and particularly in insurance, you've made this decision that there's no point really reflecting the insurer's own credit risk in that value. That's probably not what people, users, would expect to see. They may make their own assessments about the credit risk of that entity in the regulatory environment in which that insurer operates. So I see it as a measurement basis. It's a departure from fair value. It's still within the current value family, if you like. And I think you've explicitly, it would be good in the basis for IFRS 4, which the revised IFRS 4, which I assume you'll do, is to indicate how it's different and why it's different from fair value.
So it's a current value which is a market, modified market based. There are elements of it which are tied into markets, but
yep.
It's not entirely there.
That's right. And I mean, as you probably recall, the previous, not the 2013 ED, but the 2009, was it? Indicated, for example, most of the costs that you put in that should be market observable costs, and I think you kind of relaxed on that because people came back and said, for practical reasons, we really can't obtain that information. And also, you could have got into that odd situation where my costs are actually much higher than the markets, and shouldn't I reflect that in my liability? So. You know, I acknowledge at the standard setting level you're going to make these judgments about modifying your measurement basis. But yeah. I think broadly speaking, the insurance model is a current value measurement basis, sure it departs from fair value in certain ways.
But conceptually, is it a bother that it departs from fair value? I mean, current... No.
Not if you can justify
so
it.
So I just wondered why you referred back to fair value.
Well, I guess deep down we see there's essentially two measurement bases, historical cost and fair value.
Historical and fair.
Yeah.
Really? I wouldn't agree with that.
Well, and that may be more, I'll say that's more a personal view.
Okay.
But then at the standard setting level, I think you're free to depart. And then you justify the departures. And I think in the insurance case, the board's ending up in a pretty good place, and those departures are justified.
But, I mean, where I differ is I think conceptually is the fair value historical cost is not the right analysis. Wouldn't agree with you at all.
Sure.
So I don't need then to be worried about justifying so much at a standards level.
But your the paper you wrote for us
was all based on current cost.
Yeah, well, I guess if you were aiming for one, I mean, we've given up on aiming for one measurement attribute in this context.
For any second best.
But and it's interesting, this might come up in the discussion of inflationary accounting. You know, in an ideal world, we would go for a current cost framework, yes.
Well, in a less than ideal world with a lot of inflation, it might become very actual again.
It might help, yeah. But I guess the step down from that is saying that there's cost and there's fair value.
Yeah.
Well, I argued your point precisely yesterday, an aspiration towards one measurement, but I was one voice out of 14.
This aspiration was thwarted by the rest of the Stephen?
Yeah, can I ask another question, which is, I was interested in Tom's comment about impediments to change, and PP&E generally is going to be used for one thing, and that's about it, and a historic cost would seem, say, appropriate, and why would you want to do anything else? But then for financial assets, things are rather different, and a loan book can be sold, and you can realize economic value pretty easily by selling a loan book. Does this mean that fair value is the right answer for loan books, or does it mean that we should, in those circumstances, consider disclosure of an additional measure, or consider the use of OCI and two measures?
You're teeing up the next session, I think.
Okay, that's where you were going, right?
I think we don't have guidance as to what we ought to do in prioritizing measurement or what we disaggregate or aggregate within financial statements themselves, leaving what's left over for the notes. I do believe that's a very important development also, and we're doing pre-agenda research on those issues as well. But I don't think it's simply a measurement call there.
Okay. No more comments, questions. Where does that leave us, Rachel? Have we solved the whole measurement issue then?
No, I think we've had some very interesting comments here in terms of particularly around the cash flow based measurement category and how that needs to be treated, and certainly we'll feed back the comments that we've received from this meeting to the board in October, so that they're aware of the comments, and indeed we'll think about them as we go ahead with the drafting of the measurement categories papers for October. So okay. Thank you very much.
All right. So let's take a 15-minute break and then continue with disclosure, right?
That's the well,
oh, sorry.
long-term investment.
Oh, yes, Peter, please.
Thank you, Hans.
Excellent paper, Hans.
Just a small note.
Are we going to give Tom an opportunity to talk about OCI?
Peter.
Agenda paper 6A is a discussion of implications of long-term investing for the conceptual framework. And this is a paper we discussed with the board yesterday. This paper is all about, is the framework as we're developing it going to provide the board with sufficient tools to take into account the needs of long-term investors in a reporting entity, and also the needs of users of a reporting entity that has long-term investments. So those are two slightly related questions or overlapping questions, but they are separate questions, and the paper discusses them separately. The paper is not trying to reach a conclusion on, for example, which sort of measurement basis to use for long-term investments in particular circumstances, just concentrating on what tools is the board going to have available for it. Paragraphs 8 and 9 discuss one of the reasons really why we brought this paper, which is that there's a lot of interest at the government level in trying to promote long-term investment and trying to understand what part financial reporting should play in that process. Paragraphs 11 to 20 talk about the aspect which is long-term investments held by the reporting entity. And we think that the main areas where the board might need to consider long-term investment separately possibly is in relation to measurement and possibly the area of OCI as well. And to summarise what's in the paper, we concluded that what's going into the measurement chapter, once it's finalised, will provide the board with sufficient tools to think about long-term investments, and that there's no need for any further specific reference. And perhaps I'll just pause there and see if any of you have any questions or comments on that part. And I think we're really focusing on whether there are any things that we've missed out that we ought to be adding into the framework, or whether the framework as we're developing it is likely to give the board sufficient tools to think about those particular types of investment. And I should perhaps have said that this is, we've already got, as Rachel mentioned, a discussion in that chapter of the role of the business activities that are being conducted, and the fact that that is one factor that would be considered. The paper argues, and the board agreed yesterday, that there's no need to single out long-term investment as a particular type of business activity that would need special discussion in the framework.
Well, I suppose we've got a few comments, not necessarily related to this section, but more general. I mean, it's hard to just know what a long-term investor means. And presumably, IFRS is not particularly aimed at day traders, you know, or momentum buyers and sellers, because they're probably not even looking at the financial statements anyway. So you're looking at investors, or potential investors, who are actually reading the financial statements, trying to understand the cash flows of the company, which arguably are more likely than not to be interested in the long term anyway. I think it's hard to say a long term investor is going to promise to stay in for 5 years, but they're looking at the long term horizon and probably see there's value there. Now, clearly, if the price doubles, you might decide you realise all the value and you'd sell. So I do think you have to stay there forever, not to be thinking about the long term horizon. So it's probably, you know, it may be more the other way around, like what are you doing not for long-term investors, which may not be very much. Now, there is a comment somewhere here, I can't remember whether it's the front or the back, saying you can't see what extra information an existing investor would need, which a potential investor wouldn't need. But I'd like to disagree slightly with that. I think if you get into the stewardship, I think probably a current investor's, well, there is a certain amount of information that a current investor needs for stewardship, because he's been in for the year, so he cares what's happened in the last year, and probably might want to talk to management about it, whilst it's less relevant to someone who isn't even in yet and is just looking at the prospects going forward. So, for example, discontinued activities, I think, would be more interesting to a current investor, knowing why management got it wrong or whatever, than perhaps a future investor. So I'd be careful about that statement. I do agree that the board have made great strides in giving information or potentially giving information available to prospective, to long-term investors, both current and prospective. There's the stewardship angle you mentioned. I think also the focus on the performance statement, because I think long-term investors are looking for information about long-term cash flows, and I think that means that the focus on the performance statement rather than just on the balance sheet, which is increased in this draft exception framework, I think is very helpful. So I certainly agree, you know, that you've moved towards satisfying the needs of long-term investors. I just wouldn't necessarily articulate it about the way you do.
Could I just pick up on a couple of points there. I mean, it is picked up more in the second half of the paper than the first half, but there's a discussion in paragraphs 29 to 31 of whether we should concentrate just on existing investors or on existing and potential, as the framework directs us to. And we conclude there that it is right to concentrate on existing and potential. In paragraph 43, I think it is, we talk about disclosure, and we say there that we can't think really of disclosures that short-term investors might need that long-term investors won't need, but it's conceivable there could be disclosures that long-term investors might need that short-term investors might not be so interested in. But we didn't identify anything useful that we thought we could put in the framework at this stage. That's clearly something the board would need to keep in mind as it's taking standards level decisions, but we didn't see any useful framework level guidance.
Well, as I say, I think if you think about stewardship, I mean, obviously short-term investors are much less interested in stewardship. And stewardship isn't just about holding management accounts, it's also particularly for larger shareholders, it's almost having a strategic discussion. You know, I've been in situations where a large value investor is going to be saying, well, we think you should be going in a different direction, and they're using information in the financial statements to help them do that. That's different if your only decision is whether to buy or sell 50 shares or whatever, or you're just a very short-term investor in a way. So I don't think it's right. I do think it's proven that you wouldn't need any different information. Clearly, it's only at a standard level that you think what that information might be.
Is not it, Roger, a different distinction that you are making between small retail investor and large, possibly institutional investor, maybe having different behaviors and maybe having different information needs, as opposed to short versus long-term investors? Because you can be a small retail investor with a long-term view, or you can be a large institutional investor with a relatively short-term horizon. So
yeah, no, I totally agree, but it's just if you're a very small long-term investor, you're not going to get to see the chairman to say, I think you need a different strategic direction. If you've got 15%, then...
You have access to information that I don't have, yeah, for sure, yes. Yes.
Françoise?
We'd like to say first that we have not discussed this paper, so I'm not representing other than my own reactions. And I could agree with the conclusions in the paper that what you seem to be doing in the conceptual framework gives the standard, the ISB, the tools to deal adequately with whatever differential needs could be identified for information in long-term investing context. But I would have then two questions, and they're related. Do you think that, and especially when I just heard that you have qualified amortized cost as being a historical cost measure, I would want to ask whether you think that the guidance that he's proposed to be included in conceptual framework supports the treatment of equity investment in IFRS 9, just as published, and the fact that the fair value SOCI category is limited to the instruments that meet the characteristics of the instrument test.
Well, we weren't trying to answer the question what decisions ought the board to make in particular standard setting context. So for example, what to do with equity instruments or what to do with the categorization that's currently in IFRS 9. What we were looking at was what tools are available. And the measurement chapter is talking about the different types of measurement basis. It's talking about what kind of information they produce. It's talking about the factors the board ought to consider. For example, the business activities, how do they contribute to cash flows, the characteristics of the asset or liability. And we felt that what's being developed there is giving the board the right tools to think about those questions. We weren't trying to answer the specific question of what to do in those particular cases.
Yeah, I understand. I fully understand that's what the paper says, and I agree with that. We're just putting this, in fact, analysis in the existing context.
Yukio.
Yeah, we agree that there is no need to separately describe the measurement guidance for long-term investment. In our view, concerns expressed with regard to long-term investment can be addressed by setting out an appropriate definition of profit or loss, properly describing how to select measurement bases in the conceptual framework. We do not think that whether or not an investment is made for a long term or not is critical to determine appropriate measurement bases. Rather, the conceptual framework should describe how to select an appropriate measurement basis to help determine the appropriate amount of profit or loss. We believe that the selection should be made on the basis of whether the investment are held expecting the outcome from the business, or whether the investment are held solely to expect favorable price changes in the market. We believe that setting a guideline about how to select appropriate measurement bases would help address the concerns over the long-term investment.
Tom?
Thanks. Just wanted to comment that I don't think you're missing anything from the framework that for this purpose. But just to comment that particularly, I guess, in the not-for-profit area, maybe in the public sector, we've been looking at fiscal sustainability as an issue, and I can't remember where your sister board, the International Public Sector Accounting Standards Board, is up to on that. But we were certainly going to feed off the work that they were doing and think about how it might apply in the private sector. And I guess that's got a more long-term view to it, but that's the standard setting.
Tom?
I don't think a focus on long-term investors or long-term investments serve us well. The objective of financial reporting is general purpose financial statements. And it's not just about investors, it's about creditors, it's about lenders, it's a whole broad category of people that we serve with financial statements. And focusing on one subclass makes, to me, special purpose financial reporting. I don't think that sort of focus is there. I also don't think that it changing the accounting measurement to encourage long-term investment is anything but non-neutral accounting. That, because the implication would be that if we actually knew some of the volatility in the short term, we'd sell. And so we're going to hide information from people so that they stay in longer than they'd want to. That's a public policy objective that I don't think standard setters should get involved with whatsoever. I don't believe that it's really the response to this is mostly about measurement. I think it's mostly about presentation, which is selectively, if we have measurements under a measurement chapter, that introduce some sort of short-term volatility that's attributable only to this period or attributable to changes in the term structure of interest rates or cash flows long-term in the future, making sure that we separately present those. I did not say OCI. Separately present them in some way to make that clear would be the way to be able to help people make better decisions. It might be an OCI, but it may not have to be an OCI. My preference, because I don't know what OCI is or profit and loss, I have a harder time justifying that split.
Okay, just to wrap up, perhaps I should mention the second half of the paper, starting at 21, talks about whether there's anything specific we need to do for investors, long-term investors in the reporting entity. I think most of the points that are covered in the second half have already come up in the discussion, so I'm not going to go through them one by one. But our conclusion was that there wasn't anything further that we'd overlooked that we need to put into the conceptual framework.
Okay.
Hans?
Yes? Rebecca first. And
Well, the second half of the paper was the more interesting piece, and I guess I just wanted to reinforce staff's view in paragraph 34, which is the overall view I think the ISB has got to, is that the framework doesn't need to be revised, but to just emphasize, you consider the particular characteristics of an instrument, really the standard setting, we're really focused on decision usefulness, which you brought up, and something that we've been considering given some of the more contentious projects that have been happening. Our oversight board has actually been looking into what's in the public interest when it comes to setting standards and what does that mean, and trying to better explain what our role is. And we've really kind of coming to the view that it's really through due process, through consultations and having transparent deliberations to develop decision useful information. And that might be helpful to emphasize, as I know public interest is also within the ISB's mission as well. That might be another way to respond to some of the concerns that are being raised. But I also did want to say, in looking at the different user descriptions of how to consider users, I know we have gotten much better in reaching out to both investors and creditors. But what I've noticed in our, at least in our discussions, we have not necessarily identified what are potential and existing and whether they do have different information. So while it might not be a change to the framework, it could be helpful as when we are doing our consultations to maybe ask a little bit more specifically if their needs do vary. Though I'd like to wrap up on a positive note, I do have to say I need to bring back prudence to support Clement in what he expressed earlier. Because from a Canadian perspective, that was, in effect, our definition of conservatism. So this is a scenario where terms mean different things to different people. So when you look at the kind of, I noticed in the description of prudence at the this latter half of the paper, part C of paragraph 39 refers to talking about the significance of prudence for preparers and how the ISB will, in essence, will think about in setting standards. And I think what we really need to focus on is more effective communication between what the ISB intends that to have an effect and how you'll consider it in deliberations so that we can have a better dialogue. Because I think the focus on discussing uncertainty would put us in a better place than necessarily using those kinds of terms.
Stephen?
The aspect of this that interests me, concerns me, is the first part of Peter's paper, and the entities which themselves may or may not make long-term investments, and the insurance sector is one that comes to mind. We've had many meetings with insurance companies, but one sticks in my mind that happened a few months ago where we had a representative of one of the companies in here saying that they're a long-term investor and therefore they have the ability to ride out market fluctuations.
So don't bother us with them.
The implication with then the, and therefore fair value fluctuations to us are not relevant, so we should not be forced to use fair value. And some take that a step further and say, well, we should be able to value our investments at what we judge to be their fundamental value or underlying value, some sort of management-based value in use. They would see that market price changes are the result of short-term trading decisions by a small number of market participants, and therefore they should be able to ignore them. We had some time ago, I was at a conference and we had a CFO there saying that similar thing, but in terms of their pension liability. So the changes in interest rates in the market are not relevant because, well, our pension obligation is very long term. We're not going to settle it next week. Therefore, we should be allowed to use a rolling average discount rate, which is the average of the last 5 years and not the current rate, because the current rate doesn't really reflect relevant information because they're not going to settle it immediately. And these are comments that concern me.
Yeah. This is our daily life. I've even talked with highly sophisticated institutional investors who would really like to report on the basis of realized profit, whereas I'm sure that the supervisory framework they are operating in doesn't make any distinction between realized or unrealized, and I don't think economically it means very much. Okay. Questions? Is there anything else on the conceptual framework front? No? before I crush. Okay, then let's take a break for